Well, I get pig-headed and I drink too much. I'm out of state and I'm out of touch. Got a reckless heart and a beggar's knee. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. Well, I don't say much, but I love to talk. Got a funny way and a funny walk. Got a point of view that's hard to see. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. It's a hard story with soft cover. Every heart is double-spaced. Poor bookmark, there's a bottle, so I don't lose my place.
You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Gary Lee Miller, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, editors, and other people inside the world of books. Picture this. In a lecture hall in New York City, one of America's most notorious socialists addresses a crowd of thousands. In a voice both strident and confident, he condemns the American power structure, which, he says, delivers too much wealth to a small number of people at the top and too little to workers who are left in poverty. The speaker calls for a revolution, one that will reduce the power of big business and give working people a bigger slice of the pie. Here's the catch. This happened in 1906, not 2015, and the speaker wasn't Bernie Sanders, but an American literary icon named Jack London. The author of adventure novels The Call of the Wild and White Fang, London was the first American writer to become a millionaire through his book sales. But, as Cecilia Tisci's revelatory new biography of London reveals, he was so much more than a great storyteller. In Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America, released in October 2015 on University of North Carolina Press, Tisci tells the story of London's lifelong battle for the American worker and against the corporate monoliths that held so much of the power during the Gilded Age. Cecilia Tisci is William R. Keenan, Jr., Professor of English and Professor of American Studies at Vanderbilt University. She is the author of a number of books, including Civic Passions, Seven Who Launched Progressive America and What They Teach Us, and Exposés in Excess, Muckraking in America, 1900 to 2000. Our conversation about Jack London started with the reasons for her interest in this remarkable man. Hi there, and thanks for being on Write the Book with us this morning.
Well, good to be here, Gary. Cecilia Tisci, and speaking to you from Nashville, Tennessee today.
The home of country music. Let's talk a little bit about your book. Before I read it, probably the only time I've even thought about Jack London in a long while is when my kids read Call of the Wild. But after reading your book, I'm really fascinated by the guy. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your background and how it led you to Jack London.
Well, my deeper political history is probably rooted in a post-high school summer job at a glass plant in Fairmont, West Virginia, where I had the benefit of a strong union protection. And that meant guaranteed breaks, guaranteed lunch, and a lounge where women could relax over their breaks and lunch, and a very strong hourly wage negotiated by the union. Now, I took it for granted at the time, but as the years went on and labor protections diminished, and we found ourselves, as we are now, in a second Gilded Age, I started to look back at the first Gilded Age over a century ago and ask, how were things then, and how did our collective mentalities and energies help the U.S. move into a better social and political organization? Who led the way out of the first Gilded Age, which had so many problems of the kind that are besetting us today? And I've come to Jack London as a mainstay figure who helped the public understand what was wrong and what needed to be done.
That's great. Can you tell us a little bit about Jack London for people who just kind of a quick bio sketch of him for people who might not know him?
Sure, Gary. And, you know, his name pops up everywhere. Just a few days ago, a review of a book on surfing, and it led off with Jack London in Hawaii surfing, as indeed he did learn to do. Surf riding, it was called, and he said they're like brown mercury gods skimming over the waves. and you know, it's this kind of language that has attracted readers to London. London as an adventurer, as a sportsman, a sailor, up to the Klondike gold rush days, all true. He was also a war correspondent. He covered prize fights as a sports writer. But underneath, if you dig into the biography, you find a kid who grew up poor and scrambling. The family, a kind of blended family, because his abandoned mother, he was a single mother child, and she married a widower with two kids of his own, of her own, I'm sorry, and they struggled. And Jack, as a boy, helped the family with the kind of jobs that kids, boys especially, would do. Paper route, helping the iceman, setting pins in a bowling alley. But a bit later on, he had jobs of a very different caliber. And these, I think, formed his politics. He worked in a jute mill, jute making horse blankets and grain sacks out of what we would call it burlap. That was 10 cents an hour, and the shifts were as long as the boss wanted them to be. London recalled that one time he was steadily on that job for 36 hours. He worked in a cannery. And
how old was he when he...
Late teens. He was in his later teens doing these jobs. And in the cannery, there was no safety equipment on the machinery. He saw his co-workers' fingers just sort of sliced, and I think his own stepsister suffered one of those injuries. He also... mistakenly believing the employer who promised that he could start at the bottom and rise, began shoveling coal literally at the bottom in a boiler into the fiery furnace for an electric steam rail company. And he later learned that he was being paid less than two men who preceded him in that job. His wrists throbbed and ached, and he strapped leather around them and kept shoveling. And I think if he hadn't quit, he would have perhaps been permanently disabled. One more god-awful job. He worked in a steam laundry, highly mechanized, starching, ironing, pressing, vats of scalding starch. Friend stopped by to see him and said, "Jack, you've turned into a robot. You've hired out as a slave." And that's what the friend said. And London did not disagree. Those were the jobs that he saw vast numbers of American laborers trapped in, ruining their bodies, exhausting themselves, and dead by midlife. Gary, he called that way of life being a work beast. And he compared this modern way of life to a return to the feudal Middle Ages. And his writings from the very first, were meant to help instruct the public on the unfairness, the economic disparities, the kind of thing we're still coping with income inequalities right now, and schedules that are erratic, and in this gig economy we are in, with TaskRabbit as one kind of handyman job you can get, and I thought, I see, we've come from the work beast to the bunny, but there's something of the same thing going on, and there are, just as there were then, people who are horrified at the slippage of social responsibility and citizenship. And Jack London, I think, led the way back then.
That's fantastic. And I can certainly see connections to all the things you're talking about. I saw an ad the other day, I'm always looking for, writing jobs. Write a 300 to 500 word article. We'll pay you $12 for each one. And I thought, okay, how many hours will that take me, and how long? What will I have to do to make $12? It's just ridiculous. London, one thing I admired about him is from, an early age, he determined that he wouldn't live that horrible work beast life, and one way out was to become a writer. And like many writers, he found some support at the local library. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
That's a wonderful story. And I see, these days there are news reports that libraries are serving so many functions. They're no longer, long gone are the days of the warehouse of books. So London, at the Oakland Public Library, went in. His family, of course, could not afford books. There were just a very few in the household. I should mention that by age 4, he was reading, and that his mother had an education. She had really abandoned the values of her upper middle class family in Ohio, but she did value literacy, and she helped her son, taught him to read, age 4. As a boy, he wandered into the Oakland Public Library, and Ina Kubrick, the librarian who later became the Poet Laureate of California, she saw this bright-eyed, scruffy kid and helped him select books. And he was forever grateful. Later, he wrote an autobiography called John Barleycorn. It's really a terrific memoir. Very much centered on his relation to alcohol, but he commended her and how he had a crush on her at the time. So that was the first librarian, and Gary, then there was a second, Frederick Irons Bamford, assistant research librarian. Bamford, a Canadian, was himself a socialist, a Christian socialist. He read Ruskin and John Stuart Mill, and he put Jack London onto these writings, and it must have been quite a scene. Here's Jack London with his worker's clothes and scruffy and his hair kind of raked with his fingers, no comb, no brush. And here was Bamford with his silver hair carefully combed, shirt and tie, at the desk, fresh flowers on the desk, and a little display of new books. But somehow they connected, and Bamford guided Jack London toward politically leftist socialist texts, really. And they remained friends forever, attended Ruskin dinners together in San Francisco. So the libraries were, the Oakland Public Library especially, was foundational for Jack London's intellectual life.
And as a writer, he also worked extremely hard to reach the level that he could be a published writer.
Oh, Gary, did he? He was in a moment of desperation. He'd worked in the jute mill and the laundry and the cannery, and he saw that if he stayed in manual labor, he'd be dead soon. He determined to try to write. His mother supported his effort, and here was a fork in the road. It was the 1890s. The country was in a terrible depression. No jobs. And Jack took the civil service examination and passed it and was offered a postal employee's position. He asked, could he delay it? No. He had to decide right then. And his mother, who was a kind of gambler, urged that he give writing a try. There was a reason to make that bet, because just a few years earlier, one of the San Francisco newspapers ran a contest for the best writing, so many words. Jack's mother kept him awake with coffee all night, and he wrote at her insistence an account of a typhoon off the coast of Japan, and he had shipped out as a sailor, and that was one more of his great adventures. And he tended to romanticize sailing forever, and he loved to sail. So he wrote this typhoon story, sent it to the newspaper. He won $25, and he beat out the second prize, a Stanford University student. So there was reason for the mom to think that writing might be the path. Also, Jack thought this was wrong. He thought that writers earned 10 cents a word, and there he had earned 10 cents an hour at the jute mill. So he plunged in. An attic room that his mother, running a boarding house, provided for him, no insulation, hot as Hades in the summer and drafty and cold in the winter. He plunged in, and he saw the irony that he was working as hard as he had in the mills to get away from working in the mills. And it wasn't easy scraping up the money for postage to send out the manuscripts.
Right.
And at first they boomeranged right back to him, but he kept on, and then came the break. Two stories, one in the Overland Monthly, a prestigious West Coast magazine at the time, and the other, the Atlantic Monthly, that of course is still going out of New England, and that set the course for him. And so by 1903, when The Call of the Wild was published and became an overnight sensation, London had earned, in a sense, that was no fluke. He had been writing 16, 18 hours a day for the last 6, 7 years. And that made him, Call of the Wild made him famous. Instantly, he was a celebrity, his picture everywhere, and he was on his way. He became the first American writer to earn $1 million solely from his royalties. And if we remember, at that time, the five-cent piece, the nickel, was kind of the coin of the realm.
Right. $1 million was worth a lot more than $1 million is today. I wanted to talk a little bit about his kind of other method of escape, which was travel, because that played a critical role in his success as a writer. In 1897, he's 21 years old, and he goes to the Klondike in search of gold, and he didn't find gold, but he found something even more valuable, which was stories. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
He did. He went up. I mean, it was one more of those last ditch efforts. Went up to the Klondike, swarming with gold hunters at the time, and survived that winter of 97, 98 in a cabin, but listening to the stories of they were called sourdoughs, the guys who had been there a while, and the newcomers, the sort of greenhorns, and he saw them mixing with the Inuit native peoples and the snarling dogs, and there was always somebody running a saloon, Rotgut whiskey, and Jack was there listening, taking notes. He even had a diary in which he took a few notes. When he left, and he wintered in a cabin and barely surviving, he got scurvy and was told if he didn't get out of there, it would cost him his life. He then from his Oakland days around boats, he helped build a boat, rigged a sail, shot the rapids, and sailed 1,500 miles down the Yukon River, which is really the Amazon of the North, to the coast, and then hired out on a ship down to Oakland. The storehouse of stories that he had in his under his hat, he would say, was the gold that he then mined and milled, so to speak, in his fiction. So that travel, and then no sooner had he been all across the country as a famous author than he commissioned, a 45-foot sailboat, custom built for his specifications. He and his wife, he had remarried, the second marriage, much more successful, to a woman named Charmian, and they, with a small crew, planned to sail all around the world. Well, the voyage was cut short. Just as London got scurvy in Alaska, so did he get malaria and fevers and all kinds of illnesses in the South Seas. But once again, he was seeking material, fresh material, for his fiction in the South Seas, in Hawaii. And it's helpful to remember that the American public at this time, first, had a wider middle class, and that meant more time for leisure, including leisure reading. And stories of exotic places were increasingly interesting. The National Geographic was a leisure time periodical that people subscribed to and could learn about the rest of the world. And so London, who called himself a vagabond and liked that identity, and he was going to spin his yarns from all over the world, and he did. But to bear in mind, he never lost his eye for political issues. He saw them everywhere. When he went to the South Seas, he saw imperialism at work, and he wrote about it. When he went to Hawaii, though he was hosted by the elites, I mean, they were delighted. Here came Jack London on his own boat. It had taken so long out of San Francisco that his fellows, so to speak, reporters had declared London dead, all lost at sea, and then he sailed into Pearl Harbor, and he was hosted by the leading business and political figures in Hawaii, but he saw that the islands had been stolen from the native peoples, and that the sugar plantations, the pineapple plantations, were, and he used that word, feudal, operating like the Middle Ages, with serfs at work in the fields and the lords enjoying their high life. And he wrote about it finally, and much to the rage of those who thought they had him in their pocket and he would be the spokesman for their Hawaii. So it's to say, I mean, I've kind of traveled, Gary, from your original question. What about London the traveler? Yes, he loved to see other parts of the world. He reveled in it. And even when he returned to California and became a serious farmer or rancher, they call it out there ranching, that was another kind of travel. It was intellectual, it was new experiences, and he sought them. Yes.
Sure. London, obviously, he was a tough guy. I mean, he could make the trip up to the Klondike and survive when a lot of people didn't. But he did have issues with his health, both his physical health and his mental health. Did he suffer from depression?
Yes, he did, and he didn't want people to know this. He got a phrase from Friedrich Nietzsche, the long sickness, and his mind went dark. Twice he nearly drowned, and he almost let himself drown. Once in Japan while he was a sailor, another time in the coastal waters of San Francisco Bay. And indeed, he used the experience, that experience of deep depression at the end of his novel, Martin Eden, in which the protagonist hero, Martin, at the very end, is, like Jack, a successful writer. And on his way to Tahiti, he's booked a passage, and instead he slips out of the porthole of his stateroom and deliberately dives deep, 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 and ends his life. So London did suffer periodic bouts of depression, but for his public persona that was so important to him, it was always robust. He would say to correspondents that he was on the upswing, that he was getting over those smashed ankles or pneumonia or flu or his appendicitis. You know, his health records these days, if the computer were to print them out, they would go on for pages and pages. Sprains, illnesses, gut problems. And what really ended his life all too soon, at age 40, was that when sailing in the South Seas, and as I said a little bit ago, everybody on board, his wife, himself, his crew, they were all sick. They had malaria. They had strange fevers and skin eruptions. One thing they got, they're called Solomon sores. It's a viral infection, and at the time was treated with something called corrosive sublimate. It has mercury in it. And Jack slathered his arms and legs with it and was then told that, Mr. London, the kidneys cannot expel mercury, and this will shorten your life. That was in 1908. By 1916, his kidneys were failing, and indeed, that mercury poisoning is what finally did him in. But it's incredible to realize that even though he was often sick or injured, you know, even from the wrists, ankles,
right,
and would say that he just didn't like to dance. He just never somehow learned dancing, and he didn't really like to walk. And sometimes this was mistaken for laziness, but no, it hurt.
Right.
But he wanted to write and did often 1,000 words a day. That was his self-imposed quota. So rain or shine, sick or well, he was at it with his ink pen, a kind of fountain pen, and unrelenting in his writing. But it was a hard health history, his.
Sure, sure. So by 1903, he's the most famous author in America. How did success change his life? I mean, he'd grown up in such dire poverty, and now all of a sudden, he's rich.
Suddenly he's rich, and he was a big spender. He wrote at one point that, you know, as a writers want the same thing everybody wants: beefsteaks and bicycles and watercraft and hunting gear, and he just listed all these things. You know, and he made the point that more people should have these things. This was the industrial age. Factories were pumping out all these goodies, and how was it that too many people were deprived of them? So yes, he reveled in the material possibilities. Now he was told by some, London, when you make some money, you'll give up that socialism and you'll come around to the winner's side of things. And he said never, that he was a principled socialist, and he would be allied with the working class all his life. And indeed, he was. His writing, from first to last, embedded in it principles that he cared about. Let me, if I may, go back to The Call of the Wild.
Sure.
Because we know, we remember it, it's an adventure story, it celebrates freedom, it celebrates individuality, and at the end, the hero dog, Buck, escapes to the north and becomes a kind of mythic figure, and that's always the emphasis, and especially in the classroom. What gets overlooked, I think, are the long passages in the middle of that book in which the hero dog that's been captured and it's been put into harness as a sled dog with the other sled dogs, and they are whipped and clubbed mercilessly by their masters. They aren't fed enough so that if one grabs an extra ration of fish, another is deprived. And of course, that incites rivalry. They are driven sort of mercilessly, hours that are too long, and at one point the dogs all howl in, as London emphasizes, a minor key, and their song is, and this is a quote, pleading for life. Later on, they are, and here's another phrase, they are so ill-nourished and so driven that they are perambulating skeletons. And so what about these dogs? Isn't this, as London's daughter thought, an Aesop's fable for this modern moment? These dogs are parallels to the industrial workers, underpaid, driven, perambulating skeletons themselves too much of the time, not enough wages to support their families, nowhere to turn, and so London, I think, in that novel discovered one way to talk to America's more privileged citizens, to stir a sense of what it meant to be at the bottom of the society, and he found ways to touch down and teach lessons in so many of his novels and his short stories.
And he did that deliberately. Even in Call of the Wild, it was deliberate on his part to do that?
I think it was deliberate. I think in Call of the Wild, he discovered that he could do this, that he could pour out the anguish that was locked in his own muscle memory of those terrible jobs in the mill and the cannery and the furnace and the laundry, and he could move that feeling into the experience of those dogs, and that not all people, not all readers would get it, but some would get it. Enough would get it to start stirring the public to a feeling, and he had a word for that feeling. He called it a noble discontent. A noble discontent. Noble because it was on ethical and moral grounds that people would find their consciences troubled by these unfair, brutal situations socially, and then discontented on that basis, and driven to take part in a changed public opinion toward changed public policy. And I think it's no coincidence at all that Jack London lived through the First Gilded Age and into the Progressive Era, when new laws were being put on the books in different states and toward, I think, toward the New Deal. I would say that the legislation that came out of the 1930s was the legacy of what Jack London and others, of course. He wasn't the
sure.
only one, but he had the call it both the mind and the heart of the public in mind, Gary, when he wrote, it was fiction that could stir feelings. And London knew that it was that part of what fiction could do that a medical report could not do, or a policy investigative statement could not do, maybe
right.
full of numbers. And so he had a unique place as a reformer, and I do call him a reformer, because he could reach millions and he could touch feelings very deeply, and that's what others could not do with really statistically loaded reports. So I think he was a very important part. I think that if I may say, that the power of fiction to change public opinion has been undervalued or just ignored in our history in America, and we have people today who are on that job. And if I could say, John Grisham's latest novel about the horrific practices of the coal industry, scraping the
tops
really? Off the mountain. Yeah. Mm-hmm. As with all Grisham's work, it made the bestseller list, and it's an expose of those coal practices and the attorneys who enable this by, you know, working for the coal company. And Grisham's very critical of this. So even though we could say in our age of social media and sort of multiple entertainment venues, fiction still has a place, and in Jack London's time, it had a much more powerful place in culture.
Right. London, you know, used kind of his fiction as a vehicle for his political views, but he also, you know, directly participated in politics, and there's a great scene. It actually opens your book when he's giving a talk in New York City at the Grand Central Palace Exhibition Hall in, I think it was January 1906. I was wondering if you could
right.
set the scene of that for us and tell us a little bit about it and why, you know, all these people would come out to hear Jack London talk about politics.
Well, sure thing. I mean, first of all, by now he is famous. And in 1905, he had been asked, would he go on a lecture tour? The lecture bureau, and lectures were a very important part of America's, call it intellectual entertainment. You'd go out for the evening, there would be an appearance, and we still have this sort of thing. A famous author comes to town, and there's an auditorium, and you buy tickets, and you go. And then there's a signing of books. Okay. At this point, London thought, if he went on this tour giving lectures, he could spread the word about socialism. He had first delivered at University of California at the Berkeley campus of a lecture titled Revolution. And in that lecture, he challenged the capitalist system, as he would do in New York in that January you just referred to, having polished this same lecture all through the country. The lecture tour was meant to appeal to college students. They were to be the future leaders. They were getting formal educations. Jack managed one semester at UC Berkeley, one semester, cost $40. He borrowed the tuition money from a saloon keeper. Okay, by now he's famous. He's touring the country. It was a pretty grueling schedule, changing trains in the middle of the night, on to the next campus, all through the Middle West, making his way east, and then he's in New York, And also at Yale University, where a small socialist group of students kind of sneaked him in and rented the grand Woolsey auditorium, a couple thousand people there, and word was out that the socialist author was coming to speak, and socialism was getting traction in American society at the time. Third party candidacies, lots of support, growing really into hundreds of thousands, popular publications, upholding the ideals of socialism. So here's London, in New York, in this great hall, and the New York Times reported they all wear red to hear Jack London. I think mistaking perhaps his socialism for communism. He was never a communist.
Right.
He was never an anarchist. It was socialism all the way. But he stood on that stage, and he asked, why is it that in this wealthy country of nearly 80 million people, 1 million of our citizens are not properly housed and fed? How is it that 80,000 children are working out their lives in textile mills? The question was just hung in the air. And then he posed the challenge to the capitalists. What can the great capitalist say about this? Can he answer? He can't. He doesn't. He doesn't know how. And then London went into the whole explanation of what socialism should be. And it really boils down to two principles. One, that we are social beings, and he wrote about this. Are we not, as humans, social beings? Don't we live with each other? And this is our natural way. And second, shouldn't we be living in an organization, politically, socially, economically, that is an improvement on the one we now have? That's corrupt, that's one-sided, in which, and he said this, the great capitalists who have done so much to make possible bounty, a material bounty for almost all, instead prove to be hostile to this world they have made, and they stand aloof from it. And those are his words, hostile and aloof. And this can't go on. This industrial wealth should be shared, the products of it should be shared with many, many more of us. So he posed this challenge in New York, 4,000 people, I think, there, 2,000 up at Yale, spreading the word. Now, I have to say this. His wife complained that every time Jack gave a socialist speech or published essays that were very staunchly socialist, she said, his book sales slumped. and she said, the Jack London, who, say a month earlier, was called this brilliant young author, was now, after the socialist speech, this neurasthenic imposter who calls himself London. And so,
wow.
So if you know, and if, Gary, we remember, of course, the newspapers were capitalist enterprises and lived or died on the strength of advertising from other capitalist enterprises. So it wasn't that London rejected in the industrial world and all its bounty. No, he reveled in it. He just felt that the inequality was absurd and was uncivilized, and that Americans needed to recognize that, to get on the right track and change things for the better.
Right. I have to say, one of the things about the book that most surprised me was this. Jack London, Organic Farmer. Can you talk a little bit about Jack's Beauty Ranch and his vision for a new type, or actually a kind of maybe reversion to an old type of agriculture in America?
You then that, Gary, you're right on the mark there. An old reversion, a reclaiming, may I say, of an older type of agriculture. It surprised me, too. Let me just say, for any of your listeners, Jack London State Park, it's about 1 hour out of San Francisco. It's in Sonoma, kind of in the wine country, and it is his property and has survived and is now in very good hands. So it's a wonderfully interesting visit. So London at first just wanted kind of a rural retreat where he could spend weekends and get out of the city. He had been, if we remember, with his poor family, a farm boy for a while, because John London had raised crops and not been a good businessman. But Jack did not have fond memories of sitting on a potato wagon as the horse hooves thudded and it seemed boring right. and dull. But when he got up to the land he bought for a retreat, he also inherited farm equipment and livestock. And he did nothing, as I said in the book, by halves. He claimed that farm, and he saw that the soil had been worn out by bad farming practices, overuse. The farm soil had not been nourished. It had just been worked out. And his neighboring farmer boasted to Jack that he, the other farmer, had worked three farms out. In other words, had destroyed three farms. London, having been as a sailor in East Asia and having seen the terraced, we call them rice paddies, but he saw the way farming on the hillside, and he said, these people have been feeding each other for centuries and centuries on these same narrow strips of land. How have they done it? And he looked into it. He researched. He determined that he would farm in part on the East Asian model. He would terrace the hills. He would not use any chemical additives. He would plow under green crops that would nourish the soil, and he did it. By the end of his life, his livestock were winning California State Fair prizes, and he set a sustainable, he used that word one time, a sustainable agricultural model, he said, for the nation. There is nothing more important than our soil. It is the foundation of our economy, and it must be protected. And he wrote fiction that kind of made that point. There's a novel, long novel, called The Valley of the Moon, and a couple go forth, as Jack and his wife Charmian did, and they create a sustainable farm. And even as he looked forward, and he did, to something like the mega farms of today, he foresaw them at their best in sustainable agricultural practices with varied crops, row crops, orchards, varied livestock. And now that we are in a kind of I'll say a major problem of monocrops all through the Middle West,
sure.
heavy runoff that's toxic. We should look. some agriculturalists might well look to Jack London and see what needs to be done.
Absolutely, he was a visionary person in many ways. We are almost out of time, but I just had one more question for you, and that actually is connects nicely to what you just said. I couldn't help in reading this book see so many parallels to the world in which people lived in, you know, in the Gilded Age, and to the world now that we're living in. And it seems to me like Jack London would probably thrive just as well and have just as much to say about today's world as he did about his own. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think he would. I think he'd be on social media. He'd be tweeting. He would, in his own messages, I'll say, go viral. He welcomed the new motion picture industry and saw it as a possibility for his own work to be out there on reels of film. And let me mention, Gary, that in the ebook version of my book, I have managed to get archival motion picture footage from Jack London's own time. And anybody who reads the ebook will see along the way 8 little places to tap, and the screen comes alive with footage exactly from Jack London's own time. The one on the farm is Jack himself. You see him driving a team of horses and helping his wife mount her horse and grooming his own horse and so on and so on. But just to say, he would very much be a figure alive on our socio-cultural scene and urging that our own organization rethink itself, wage inequality that's horrific, our prison system, and we're finally getting some movement on that. All these millions of people in jail for their nonviolent drug offenses, and so on and so on. So yes, the reason I think to look at Jack London is to see how in the midst of what seemed set in stone as an organization of our world, the Gilded Age, indeed that stone broke up or that ice melted and we had a much better era, and one individual could help make that difference, and I think that's a lesson that people could well profit from today.
Cecilia Tichy, thanks so much for being on Write the Book today. It was a fantastic discussion. The book, Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America, it's out on UNC Press, and it's available everywhere. Thank you so much.
Gary, thanks to you.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Cecilia Tichy, author of Jack London, A Writer's Fight for a Better America, published in October 2015 by University of North Carolina Press. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. And by the Farmhouse Tap and Grill, a farm-to-table gastropub serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and world-class craft beers. Thanks for listening to Write the Book. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at the website of Write the Book host Shayla Shapiro, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. The theme song for this episode of Write the Book is by Possum. You can find them on Facebook. I'm Gary Lee Miller, and you can find out more about me at GaryLeeMiller.com. I'm looking forward to more great book talk, and I hope you'll be here next time. This has been Write the Book, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.
It's a hard story with a soft cover. Every heart is double-spaced for a bookmark. There's a bottle, so I don't lose my place. Well, I get too high or I get too low, stay out late or just don't go. Say what you want, I'll disagree. I could write a book.
He could write a book.